Representative for the Fishing Communities Coalition. He says the coalition is happy for the extension, but some further changes may need to happen.
There's some fishermen who went through the original PPP process and, you know, after this 1099 fix are possibly going to be unable to access additional PPP funds for their crew, which is what this fix was intended for.
Frelick adds that the coalition is monitoring further proposals to ensure the fishermen who did apply before the rule change will either be able to file a second time or amend their original application.
A lot of it's uncharted territory, right? We're doing a lot of new innovative things to make sure our economy survives this pandemic. And, you know, we are thankful to the federal government and to our representatives in state government for doing all of these things. But we also need to be flexible, adapt to what we are finding to be problems along the way, and fix those problems.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans, on the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Now let's shift to Southeast Alaska, where there have been a number of whale incidents. Federal wildlife officials are asking the public to be on the lookout for an entangled humpback whale reported near Sitka. They say the best way to help a whale caught up in lines or debris is to call in its location and to keep a safe distance. KCAW's Erin McKinstry has more.
Whales can get entangled in all kinds of stuff, from anchor lines to fishing gear to shrimp pots, which is what happened with the latest case near Sitka. NOAA Fisheries received a report on June 29th of an entangled humpback just south of Sitka Sound near Tava Island. That's about 8 miles from where the owner of the shrimp pots set the lines the previous Saturday morning. Whale entanglements are infrequent in Alaska. NOAA Fisheries reported just 10 sightings statewide in 2018. But most of those occurred in Southeast. And when the giant creatures do get entangled, the results can be deadly. That's according to Alaska's Large Whale Entanglement Response Coordinator, Sadie Wright.
We know that any type of entanglement is a big energy expenditure for whales, so wasted energy dragging all this stuff around. But in worst-case situations, entanglements can lead to the death of the animal.
But the public's responsibility stops at communication, Wright says. Intervention can be dangerous for the whale and for humans. Props can get stuck in lines, and the public doesn't always know the best course of action, like the Good Samaritans that cut buoys off the lines attached to this whale. Buoys actually helped the team's trained responders find large whales and figure out how to free them.
Thank goodness that these Good Samaritans didn't get hurt. While well-intentioned, freeing a 40-ton animal is extremely dangerous for the animal and the would-be rescuer.
The team has specialized equipment that allows them to maintain distance and free the whale if necessary. But Wright says they're hopeful that this guy will free himself.
Based on the speed that this animal is traveling, we think it's a strong and very mobile animal. And we know that most entanglements of large whales conclude with the animal freeing itself. So we're hopeful that this animal is able to do that.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Mary McKinstry.
Gray whale strandings are on the rise on the West Coast and here in Alaska. Biologists don't fully understand what causes the huge animals to become caught upriver or on a beach, which makes the collection of tissue samples and other data from the dead whales critically important. Near Sitka recently, three campers had an unprecedented opportunity to aid the cause of science when they discovered a stranded gray whale and her calf. But the animals, who are both quite alive, were no help at all. Robert Woolsey has more.
Harry Edwards, Michelle Putz, and Leah Mason are sheltering on my front porch from a light summer rain. They're just back from a long June weekend on Kruzoff Island, Sitka's wild and remote next-door neighbor to the west. Kruzoff is famous for its black sand beaches, open to the Pacific swells and surf. The three were staying at the North Beach cabin. Edwards woke up early to go beachcombing.
It was a super low tide. I mean, there was this beach that went on forever. And I looked over at that rock wall in the south end, and I saw something blow, and I thought, maybe that's just a splashing of a wave. There's not enough water for anything to be there. And then I looked again, and then I saw a pectoral fin flip over, and I ran back to the cabin and said, hey, Michelle and Leah, there's a whale. that's stranded and there's no way it can get out.
A whale this close to a beach, not to mention stuck on it, is not uncommon. Not for gray whales, anyway. They're benthic feeders who dredge the ocean bottom for food.
It's not unusual to see gray whales in the area foraging or swimming near shore.
Mandy Keough is the Alaska Stranding Coordinator for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
So they will actually go down and kind of disturb the sedimentation and use that to get amphipods and other organisms like that. So it's not uncommon to see them near shore in shallow waters.
Keough says this whale was not stranded by definition, but alive, on shore, and unable to return to the water. But try telling that to the whale, or in this case, whales, because there were two, a mother and calf.
These whales were in such a small space that it looked like eels in a bucket.
This is Leah Mason.
Yeah, you could see them roiling in there.
And Michelle Putz.
Yeah, you would definitely, you could see their backs and most of their bodies sticking above water for much of the time. There was a female, we think, and a calf, the calf being three quarters the size of the female. And the female was trying constantly to get out, find different ways to get out. And so she would be pushing her way out, swimming around, and at times she'd get stuck on one of the sandbars and kind of have to inch her way off of it so that she could get into slightly deeper water.
The tide pool was about 5 feet deep, just enough water to support the whales and prevent them from being crushed by their own weight. But the very low tide appeared to be at its lowest. Edwards and Putz both work for the U.S. Forest Service, where Edwards is a biologist and district ranger. He radioed the Sitka Forest Service dispatcher to report the situation to NOAA. That was really all they could do, or even bear.
We know in our hearts that they have gone through the worst that they're going to, and they're really active, so that's a good sign. And if we sit here and watch, we're going to give ourselves ulcers.
You know, you're looking at a 40 to 50 foot whale, and if it's stranded and in distress, you can easily become injured just by it trying to, you know, reposition itself or move.
Mandy Keough says the best thing anyone can do during a marine mammal stranding is to take pictures and report the event to NOAA. If a pathologist can get to the animal soon after it dies and collect and preserve tissue samples, researchers might be able to unravel why the animal went ashore. Last year in Alaska, 40 gray whales beached and died, and this year we're already ahead of that alarming pace. A couple of hours later, our trio returned to see how the mom and calf were faring, and perhaps to offer some interspecies support.
The larger animal was ceaseless, just circling and having a go at the sandbar and coming back.
We saw her surfing in the waves a few times as she was going along. You'd see her kind of going sideways, and suddenly you'd see a whale, you know,
emerge.
in the wave, kind of, you could see her shadow through that whole wave sideways. It was quite beautiful and sad.
We'd love to be able to just tell them, just be patient, the tide's coming in.
Right.
Yeah.
And Jan Straley said that we were probably 12 to 15 feet away. We were up on the rocks. And Jan Straley felt very strongly that absolutely they could hear us.
Jan Straley is a whale biologist in Sitka and a member of the Alaska Marine Mammal Stranding Network, which kicked into action after Edwards' radio call. Plans were already underway to perform a necropsy on these whales, but nature did not cooperate. The Stranding Network would have to settle for an interview after the fact.
The cow made yet another run that we thought wasn't going to get anywhere, and she went through. And as soon as she did, that second whale just instantly shot right out behind her, and we watched him go off into deeper water, and we cheered them on. And it was also at the same time the Coast Guard was flying over, because unbeknownst to us, there was a bunch of things that were put in play with NOAA and the Coast Guard and Jan Straley here in town trying to figure out what's going on with this whole thing.
So science was thwarted and the whales got away. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And finally, NOAA Fisheries Alaska Marine Mammal Stranded Hotline reports that a recreational boat collided with a humpback whale just outside of Auk Bay, north of Juneau, on June 27th. The U.S. Coast Guard relayed information that the family in the vessel immediately returned to shore, and some members were transported to Bartlett Regional Hospital with serious injuries.
Oh, The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part.
And good morning and welcome to the Garden Show. I'm Molly Kabler.
And I'm Kitty LaBounty.
And today's show is a call-in show. 747-5877 is the number. But our theme this morning is about shrubs. There are many, many, many shrubs to talk about. And what I'll tell you is we aren't going to talk about the shrubs that have berries. We're going to do another show about raspberries and blueberries and currants. So this morning's show is about shrubs and primarily ornamental shrubs, shrubs for looking at. And we wanted to start with the rhododendrons since there are always a lot of questions about rhododendrons, but we do have a long list of other things we want to talk about. So fear not if rhododendrons are not your best thing, right?
Exactly. So we also want to clarify that if you have questions about other things, we're happy to answer them. So please still call in if your questions aren't about ornamental shrubs. No worries at all. Rhododendrons. I actually tried to write down a list of all the shrubs I had in my garden, and rhododendrons are certainly a staple. And they're a staple because for us, they are so easy. They love the pH of our soil. They seem to really love our climate. And they don't take, I think, a lot of work at all. Really, it's just, you know, a little pruning and a little feeding and a lot of enjoyment.
One of the things about rhododendrons is that they are a shrub that brings us the full season of interest. So we're just finishing the big bloom season, the gaudy season. But all through the winter, most rhododendrons hold their evergreen leaves and really provide a lot of beauty throughout the year. So there's high value in rhododendrons. I know some people would say they're not that easy because you have to deadhead them and all of that. Some people say you don't have to deadhead them. So that's kind of a personal preference. I think you might get a better bloom set if you deadhead those flower tops. And you might like the way your shrub looks better if you deadhead them, take off those spent blooms before they turn into seed. But you're certainly not going to kill your rhododendron by not doing so.
No, I deadheaded my rhododendrons, or at least the larger ones, until they got large. I mean, really large. And then I finally went, I just can't do it anymore. So they get stuck there. The smaller ones, I'll still go around and deadhead a little bit. For me, it's mostly cosmetic. I haven't noticed any real issues with them putting a lot of energy into seed production. So that really hasn't been an issue for the selection of rhododendrons I have. But on the big ones, yeah, you get to a point where you're just like, I am not going to pick every bloom off of this 12 by 12 shrub. This is not happening. So I might prune a couple that I get close to, and by pruning those off, you just have to take just the flower stalk off, being careful not to remove the new leaf whorls or groups of leaves that are coming right behind those flowers. So pretty straightforward pruning. It can get sticky and gross, but you can do it.
747-5877 is the number if you want to call and ask us questions about rhododendrons. The other thing to think about rhododendrons right now is we're just right in a great time of year to fertilize your rhododendron. We generally suggest you fertilize twice a year. So this would be the second time. If you didn't do it the first time, no worries, but don't put double the fertilizer on. Do the same amount. Rhododendrons have very shallow roots. They like chunky organic soil, and a heavy dose of fertilizer doesn't do them any good. They actually exhibit a burned look on their leaves if they get too much. So we recommend prepared rhododendron food and follow the package. That means look at the size of your plant or shrub and estimate what they recommend. And then you put it right around the drip line and inside underneath the leaves. So not right down by the trunk, but underneath sort of that space that the rhododendron shadows.
Yeah, and I just kind of scatter mine underneath. And when in doubt, use less fertilizer, not more fertilizer. So we're talking about our happy rhododendrons, and rhododendrons really do like, if you have a forest soil that they're growing in, they should be pretty happy. They're not as happy growing in lawns. they're not as happy growing in straight volcanic ash. They don't like that sort of stuff. So if you're in a situation where your rhododendron's struggling, look at the soil conditions for that rhododendron. It could be that, you know, if your rhododendron's on a lawn, you're trying to keep your lawn happy. So keeping your lawn happy makes your rhododendron unhappy. So you kind of have to figure out, you know, which one's more important to you. And maybe that's not the best place to have your rhododendron. You can always move it. They actually move pretty easily despite being, in some cases, rather large. You know, they're certainly easier to move when they're in their smaller state. And certainly, you know, think about where you plant it the first time. But if it's in a spot that maybe you just need to add more organic matter, you know, kind of a very light amount of organic matter, and then make sure the soil is still acidic.
Kitty, the point about moving rhododendrons, I think, is well worth noting. Even the large ones can move. As I mentioned earlier, they're shallow rooted, so you don't have to dig deep. You need to dig about as wide as your rhododendron plant is. You can slide it onto a blue tarp and drag it where you want to replant it, having prepped the hole wide versus deep in advance. So that's a good thing. When you read the literature about rhododendrons, they often say they need shade. Well, that's coming in a place where there's a lot of sun. So in our climate, you're actually going to have a better result if your rhododendron is in sun. And that's one of the reasons that people struggle with, oh, I had this beautiful rhododendron, it bloomed really well, and now it's not doing anything. What's my problem? Two problems, either soil and competition fertilizer, we talked about that already, or this plant is much more in shaded than it was originally. It's, you know, there's the trees or other plants that have grown up around it. So that can be your other problem about why a rhododendron has stopped flowering.
Right. They can take some that dappled light. It doesn't have to be the full sunspot that maybe you want to put your carrots in, but they can certainly take that as well. But the deepest, darkest shade is hard on them here. We just don't have quite enough sunlight. And azaleas are kind of in the same package. Azaleas are actually another kind of rhododendron. They're all genus rhododendron, but we tend to use that term for the deciduous ones around here. That is the ones that lose their leaves. And they come in incredible colors. I have a suite of like a hot pink, a bright golden yellow, and an orange one. And it's just like, woohoo. I just love that bright splash of color. And again, they like that are acidic forest soil conditions. So I'm very happy to have them in my garden.
The last thing is, if you're choosing a rhododendron or an azalea, you decided, oh, I need to add that to my palette here of what's happening in my garden. Yeah, give yourself a bright one if you can stand it. I know my garden is super gaudy in late May and June with rhododendron and azaleas in bloom. But the other thing to really pay attention to is the size. So there's size of leaf, but it's the size of the plant. And in Sitka and around here, oftentimes our rhododendrons grow even bigger than the tag that comes at from the nursery says it's going to. And I think that's because we have optimal climate conditions for rhododendrons. So just make sure you read the tag and don't plan a small spot for a really big rhododendron, because you're headed for frustration in terms of trying to maintain it in a size that fits with either the rest of your house or your other plants that you don't want to be squashed out by this rampaging rhododendron that's starting to shade everything out.
Right. You can prune them back. You can prune just for size. You can actually do a pretty heavy duty rejuvenation sort of pruning sort of event on your rhododendron. If you're going to hack your rhododendron all the way down, I'd recommend doing it earlier in the year than right now. But if you have to try it, I wouldn't do it much later than right now. You want it to be able to get some growth out. You probably lose at least a year of blooms by doing this heavy hack down, you know, to a foot tall sort of rhododendron. But a lot of them can take it. Not all of them. And I don't have a list of which varieties can take it. But if you really need to do that, don't hesitate. Just do it now and be done with it.
Yep, move on. All right, well, we know there's so many shrubs to grow besides rhododendrons and azaleas, so we wanted to, you know, start with that. If you have a question, 747-5877 is the number. Otherwise, we want to move on to lots of other beautiful shrubs to grow for color of leaves and scented flowers. There's a lot of things to enjoy about shrubs in your yard. I would say the other caveat that fits in here, just like the rhododendrons, is remember a small shrub in a small pot from the nursery is going to turn into a much larger shrub. So take a look at that tag and guess how big you think it's going to be and actually give yourself the room. Otherwise, frustration and the idea that you're going to dig it up and start over because it's too big for your site. And that's not a fun thing.
No, and a lot of them do grow really well here. I was trying to think about the best. One of the things that I really like about some of the shrubs in my yard is that they're blooming in December and January and February. They're blooming at times when really you kind of need that little boost in the deep dark. And one of the best ones for that is that new dawn viburnum. And I just cannot recommend that too many times, I don't think, because it will bloom throughout the winter with these lovely pink flowers that have a nice little scent, you know, in the deep and the dark. So if you're going to have only one winter shrub that's blooming, I would pick that one.
So it's sometimes also known as Pink Dawn. It's Viburnum burkwoodii, and it's a hybrid. But it is a tough shrub that does really well here. Long-lived, pretty vigorous grower. You can cut it back easily, and it does, you know, it doesn't blink. So the Viburnum burkwoodii, Pink Dawn or New Dawn, really beautiful, useful shrub.
And I can't guarantee it, but I have seen our wintering Anna's hummingbirds in those blossoms. So there's a little added one. You might get this bright jewel flying through your pink flowers as well.
There are other viburnums that are worth growing, probably not quite as robust as the burkwoodii, but the tomentosum is certainly a beautiful one, also known as the mariesii. That has a beautiful layers of white flowers, if you can get that one going. And it's a shorter plant, you know, maybe to 5 or 6 feet versus the Pink Dawn, which is almost small tree size once it really gets going.
Yes, the other viburnum I have in my yard that's doing super well, almost too well, I actually need to start taking it back down a notch, is another one that's opulous. It's the European, and I'm trying to think of a good common name for it, viburnum. Opulous is the species. The leaves look kind of like our highbush cranberry, if you're used to looking at highbush cranberry, but the flowers are much different. They almost look like a hydrangea-type flower. And it's taken a little while, but it's really taken off growth-wise. So there's a lot of viburnums, but like I said, I think my favorite really is that winter blooming one. Going back to another winter bloomer that I know I've talked about is the witch hazels. I'm thinking of another plant that blooms in January and February, and the added bonus to that one is that the leaves can turn incredibly beautiful colors in the fall. So you get these flowers in January, February. You get a nice form of the plant, and then you get the nice leaf color.
So we have a call. Hello, you're on the Garden Show.
Good morning. Thank you for doing the show. I have Siberian iris in the front yard. They're crowned out and need to be thinned. So if there's anyone listening that wants Siberian iris, they're in the yard and they're free. It's at 1105 Edgecombe Drive. The number is 747-8827. And be sure and sharpen your shovel and bring a teenager.
I like that recommendation.
All right, so this is some crowdsourcing, both help and offering a return on that. So we appreciate your call. So Siberian iris, have your irises kind of stopped blooming as robustly? Is that part of the reason why you wanted to?
That is exactly true. They are overcrowded and therefore not producing.
All right.
Yep. great advice. That's a good time to do it. And irises do super well here. So, yeah, you definitely need to do the dividing periodically. So thanks for offering them up for sharing.
Do you want to tell us your phone number one more time since you're accepting calls from folks that will now be listening closely for the number?
747-8827.
All right. Thanks so much for your call and for sharing in the garden fun.
Thank you. Have a good morning.
You too.
You too. Yes, that's a good reminder. Watch when things start getting crowded. If they stop blooming, that's probably what's going on. They need to be divided. So good, very good point.
Thanks for your call. So, Kitty, another shrub that I think is just a really popular one around town is the Daphne Mesarium, and it's the other one that has like so many seasons of interest. It's one of our earliest blooming shrubs. It's, in my mind, one of the sweetest smelling things. And it has bright red berries later in the summer, late summer to fall. And the leaves kind of almost give you a little bit of color as well.
Right. That's a lovely one. I have that one also in my yard. And then another one that maybe people haven't thought of is something called a winter hazel, Corallopsis. And that, again, blooms not quite as early as some of the other ones, but it has a nice form. It has really lovely sprays of kind of soft yellow flowers. And the leaves also change color in the fall. So I really like to have these shrubs that have kind of a mixture of leaf color. They have some flowers, you know, some of them also have berries, you know, not necessarily ones we're going to pick, but there's this multiple season interest going on. And I've also noticed on years when we have really, really wet summers, the shrubs are providing the most oomph in my garden sometimes. It's like, oh, okay, the flowers looking a little peaked, but oh my gosh, those shrubs and their flowers are looking good.
Another one I think that sort of fits your description of multi-season interest are the cotoneasters. And the other thing about the cotoneasters is they're another really tough one. And if you're struggling with what can go in a place that I just can't fuss about, cotoneaster is your babe. And they have a couple of different varieties, but they tend to be low and sprawling or spreading, so they do need a little bit of room. The bees love them. They have sweet but inconspicuous flowers, and then they offer up some berries later in the season.
Right, so that's a really good choice. I have a shrub blooming right now in the garden that I'm kind of in love with. I did post a picture of it on the Sitka Facebook that gardening and horticulture group. So if you're curious what I'm talking about, it's called colquitzia or beauty bush. It's one of those shrubs that, yes, you need to read the tag and see how big it's going to be because it gets big. But it is covered right now with these flowers that look like snapdragons. I mean, they're just lovely color. And again, the birds just love it. The hummingbirds are in it all the time. It's not as much of a reward other parts of the year, but right now, it's just flat out gorgeous. And so it's what I recommend.
So it's the colquitzia. Let's say that again so people who
yes,
have now
convinced. Yes, colquitzia, or it's also called beauty bush.
All right. So a couple other really easy ones. I can't say I always think they're the most beautiful, but they're tough and you know, easy to grow are the potentillas and the spireas. And there's just a lots of different varieties of both of these. The potentillas tend to be smaller, yellows and whites and almost to orange little flowers. They do fine. And then the spireas tend to be a little bit taller and rangy, whites and pinks usually for their flowering stalks.
I have a short spirea, which I actually forgot on my list, that has a really lovely colored sort of golden foliage and a darker pink flower, which I really enjoy. But I wanted to caution folks about spireas is at one point in time, I moved a rhizomatous, so a spirea that moves by underground stems into my garden, and it has lovely, really pretty flowers, but oh my goodness, I am... like keeping that one in check nonstop. So again, it's kind of things that spread by runners will keep you on your toes. And there are shrubs that do that as well, which might actually be a nice little lead in to roses.
Perfect.
So our rugosa roses are not native to Sitka, despite being called Sitka roses. They're, of course, from Japan, but they love our climate. They do super well here. You can see fantastic examples of Sitka roses all over town. The Pioneer Home, there's a really beautiful hedge of them actually over by the Mount Edgecombe swimming pool as well right now. So they do super well. You can find doubles and singles. They can be white. They can be pink. They do super well. The only problem I can ever see with those is they do spread really very happily by underground stems. So you kind of have to keep them in check.
So right now, a lot of people are picking petals and making things, rose petal jellies and other craft products. The rose hips are high in vitamin C and fun to think about doing things with, and offer certainly great interest in just the way they look on the bush later into the fall. So a lot to like about roses. There are other roses to grow. I don't think we want to go too much into that. The classic tea rose, often people have grown elsewhere and they move here and they still want to grow those tea roses. We don't have the climate for those, so if you have to, just buy them and consider them annuals and enjoy them for a year. So buy a mid-sized one, enjoy it, and carry on if it's something that just is a touch point for your garden and you have to have it. There are some of the smaller rambliers of the roses that you can grow here. It's kind of, we could do a whole show about this, but they're not easy, and that's, I think, the thing to keep in mind. So if you're ready for a challenge and you're up for it, go for it.
Right. I have two other roses in my yard that are doing pretty well. One's an alba, so it's an old rose, you know, like, and by old, I mean like Middle Ages. That's when this one first came into cultivation. And it actually is doing pretty well, and it blooms really nicely every year. And I also have a sweetbriar, which isn't always doing quite as well, but I love that plant because if the leaves are wet and you brush up against them, it smells like apples. I mean, strongly like apples. It's not subtle at all. So it's worth it to me to kind of fuss along with it and put up with it, not always looking as ideal as I might want it. And that's the way people are about certain plants, right? You just want them and you're willing to fuss with them and take care of them and maybe replant them if they need it. And maybe tea roses are that item for you.
The other one that might be for you are the lilacs. So there's many people that want to grow lilacs, and you have to keep trying until you find one that does well here. I think some of the past problems with the powdery mildews and things that really can take over lilacs, the breeding of them has been better and the varieties are stronger. But sometimes it's the get a stock of one from your neighbor that's really doing well here in Sitka is your best bet rather than trying to buy one. The other thing to know about lilacs is they do not like acid soils. So that's the battle of the lilac, is you have to keep your soil sweet by adding lime. On the plus side, if you want to grow a shrub in your lawn, and this is the L, this is how you remember, lawn, lilac, lime. Those all go together. And there you go. If you want to grow a lilac in the lawn, I think you should.
They do. They would really enjoy that. The one I have in my garden, I have to feed like oyster shells to and lime and whatever else, and, you know, cut down tree branches to give it more light. I have to do a little battle for that one. But one I don't have to do battle with that I wanted to mention that's kind of an oddball is a willow. I know, she's like, a willow? But this willow has black catkins and red stamens or reproductive parts. So when it comes out in the winter, you get this big black cool catkin. So that's that kind of oval shaped fuzzy bet that you might call a pussy willow. But instead of gray, it's black. And then it has little red, you know, dots on it every once in a while. And they grow super well. They're just beautiful. And it's one that propagates really easily by just cuttings. In fact, that's how I got it. I grabbed a one that I saw at a garden show, and it cut in a vase. And I just carried it along with me, put it in water. It formed roots. I planted it, and it's very happy.
A lot of willows grow in Alaska. We have lots of native willows. So if you think about it, that's a probably easy choice to grow. They can grow rapidly and kind of take over. So that's the thing to think about with willows. But certainly plants with a lot of interest, and there's lots of different willows. Not so common. You don't see them sold much, but they're really an interesting one. I think the other one that kind of fits in with the easy to grow are the ribes. And literally that is our other show with our currants, because it's a currant, it's a berry bush. But the ribes sanguineum, or sanguineum, however you want to pronounce that one, is really best grown for its showy pink flowers in the spring. And that's another one. Just get a clip from your neighbor, root it in water, and away you go.
It's so lovely. It's a plant that's actually is native to the Pacific Northwest, that was transported or taken back to, I think in this case it was England, and then kind of messed with, cultivated, and then came back to us actually as a cultivar. And it does seem to really like our climate quite well. So it's definitely one I recommend.
So another one I get a lot of questions about are hydrangeas. People want to grow hydrangeas, and they have there's mop-headed hydrangeas, the big floppy flowered, the bright blue ones, they're bright pink. You see them in commerce in all different styles and shapes and sizes. And for years, we always said hydrangeas don't grow here. But there are hydrangeas that grow here. The most the easy one to grow, of course, is probably the climber. Do you grow that one, Kitty?
Yeah, I have a nice one that's growing actually up the side of my woodshed that's blooming right now as well. And it's been relatively slow growing. It may not be in its, you know, super most ideal spot there, but I've just left it to grow up the woodshed.
So we have a call. Hello, you're on the garden show.
Hi, it's Jennifer. And funny you mentioned hydrangeas. I have a climbing hydrangea in a pot. And its leaves are turning brown. The brown starts in the middle and works its way out, and the leaves fall off.
Hmm.
Do you see any growth on the underside?
Oh, God.
You know, like
outside.
Yeah. I was going to quick have to look for you. I mean, how is it? Is it happy in its pot? I mean, they are plants that like some space. So that could be part of the problem.
Well, I'm going outside now. It is happy. It has been happy. I think I've had it for 3 years now. But let me look under this one that's getting brown. Can you still hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you. And while you're taking a look, just always know that something will do well in a pot for a while, and that it either is root-bound or exhausts a nutrient in the pot. So it could be the time change. I mean, the time change, but over time, the change in conditions.
Is it time to take it out now, darn it all?
Probably.
It's on my screen, kind of covering the ugly house.
It's interesting. The other thing I'm seeing about climbing hydrangeas is they don't necessarily like full sun. So it could be that it needs a little bit more shade in its world.
Okay, that could be it too, because it definitely gets the full sun in the summertime anyway. Okay, that's all. Yeah, I haven't seen any bugs on it. I might have found one of those spit bug things.
And the spit bugs usually won't cause a problem. But it could be that it's having some leaf burn issues. But I'll see if I can find some more information about that. Mine only gets morning sun. If we have it, it'll get morning sun. And then, you know, maybe it's not like in the dark, but it's not in the full blazing heat of the day sun. And it looks pretty happy. So I'm kind of wondering if it might be a sunshade issue.
And here's one other thing, is one of the branches is completely bare and kind of dead now. There were a lot of very green leaves that fell off of it. And this other one that's pretty bare does have a new leaf growing, but it's sort of like two branches are looking really bad. So does that go for the same thing, too much sun?
I would try, if you can move the pot, I would move it and then look for a good spot for it in your garden.
Okay. All right. That'll be a challenge. Okay. Hey, thanks, you guys. I really enjoy talking to you and hearing your show.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the...
Okay. Bye, guys.
Bye.
All right. So we're just about out of time. We have about a minute left, but there are other hydrangeas to try. Oftentimes, they freeze back to the ground, and then they start again from the ground. So they don't act terribly shrubby, even though they are a shrub. And the problem is it's challenging to get them to rebloom if that's your situation. There are a few around town here and there that are hardy and shrub-like and bloom. So it's possible.
Right. If you see one blooming in that yard, I would like maybe consult with that person, or you could talk to one of the garden center people and see if they can recommend a specific type of hydrangea that will grow well for us.
So thanks so much for joining us here on our show this morning, talking about shrubs. There's so many to talk about. We didn't get to them all, but thanks for joining us. We'll be back on another Friday morning. Schedule's a little up in the air, so listen for us at 9:30. You've been listening to The Garden Show. I'm Molly Kabler.
And I'm Kitty LaBounty.
KCAW Sitka.